I should note, I've never had envy of what a woman is wearing today until Alicia walked in this morning wearing her Peyton Manning Bronco jersey. First time ever I've had a woman walk by and think, I want what she's wearing. just saying, it happened. Just her top. I'm sure her jeans probably wouldn't fit me. Sorry to embarrass you. Well, now we're back on right footing, right? Today's big day. I loved last week was awesome. You could have woken up out of a hibernation and known yesterday last week that it was the first week of football. I had the whole Brown family up here decked out in Bears gear, and many of you were dressed up, and that was fine and good. But I'm a Broncos fan. I'm Charlie. Hi. For those of you that are new, I'm Charlie. Hi. I'm a Broncos fan. I'm not just a Peyton Manning fan. I think you're just a Peyton Manning fan, aren't you? Yeah. I'm a real Broncos fan. I'm more deserving of a shirt like that than you. So today's a fun day if you're a Broncos fan. Today is, for those of you that know nothing about football, Peyton Manning is the older brother on the left, the quarterback for the Broncos. Eli Manning is on the right. He's the quarterback for the Giants. Peyton's probably the better quarterback, but Eli has won more Super Bowls, and so it'd be fun to sit around their family dinner table, I bet. I'm sure, especially if you're the younger brother. And so today, I have like four reasons I think that you should root for them. One, the Broncos' offense is just better. They have better wide receivers. The Giants turned it over 6 times the other night against the Cowboys. And so, you know, like, seriously. Peyton is just, he's at the twilight of his career. Who knows how many more seasons he has? And so we want him to have a Super Bowl this year. Everybody wants that. All right? If you don't pay attention to football, you should just know that everybody wants Peyton Manning to get that. Let's see, what other reasons should you vote for them? I mean, come on, Bronco uniforms are cool. What's better than just the burnt orange? I love the Broncos uniforms. And then if there's nothing else, if you can't think of anything else, just think of your pastor who really wants them to win. And for him to have a good state of mind going into a busy week, it'd be nice if the Broncos won so I won't be depressed all week. That's all the reasons you should vote for the Broncos today. Let's move on. All right. As we get into 1 Peter... As we get into 1 Peter, we're going to approach this from a position of rhetoric. We're going to talk about rhetoric quite a bit. Rhetoric is the art of argumentation. It's how one structures an argument in order to be effective in the argument. So you think through the process. So I gave you the heading. I'm a Broncos fan. I gave you 3 reasons why you should vote for the Broncos. I ended with an emotional appeal, the pathos. We'll get to that in a second. That you should vote, you should root for them today just because of passion, because you like me, you should root for them, right? That is rhetoric. Our politicians do rhetoric, our teachers do rhetoric, everybody we know, we just do rhetoric in normal everyday conversations. We practice rhetoric. We think through our argument, we lay out our argument, my argument. You should root for the Broncos today. Send them good vibes, all right? If that sort of thing happens. That's my proposition. And then I had a couple cheesy arguments about it, and then I had an appeal to your passion. That's just basic stuff. In the Western world, beginning with Aristotle, most of our education is built on rhetoric. Aristotle is the first to really talk about rhetoric in a big way. That's Aristotle without his eyes. And he talked about 3 forms of argumentation in rhetoric: logos, pathos, and ethos. And those are going to come up for us as we study 1 Peter. This isn't just wandering. This is going to come up for us. What Aristotle said is that when you're arguing, sometimes much of the argument is logos. It's argument. It's logical. It's this is the reason and this reason and this thing and this thing. This is the part where the engineers are all leaning in going, I accept this argument. I do not accept this argument. He also said then that sometimes part of the argumentation, and it's a legitimate form of rhetoric, is to appeal to one's passions, to get excited, to make your audience cry, to make your audience laugh. This is where the engineers roll their eyes, and the artists all go, yes, I'm feeling this argument now, right? It's just a different part of the argument. And then ethos is the other part that Aristotle talked about, and he said that in this part, it's about how it's lived out. It's the 2 parts of this. One, it's the ethos of the speaker. The character of the speaker. And he says, there's an argument that sometimes it's just about the character of the speaker in the room. That if I speak well, if I go through this process well, if I have good transitions and good arguments and I behave myself well with my audience and I don't unnecessarily embarrass people or call them out, which I've already done to several people this morning, if I build good rapport with my audience, that's part of it. It's not just the arguments, but it's the ethos of the speaker. But also then some people say it's not just the ethos of the speaker in the room, it's the ethos of the speaker outside of the room. It's everything that I bring into here. And so in the pastoral setting, it's when that pastor has spent time sitting by your bedside as you were sick, or did your wedding well, or, you know, said the right name at the funeral. You know, like those things build ethos so that when I come into the room, I don't start in this setting, I don't start with a blank slate with most of you. Some of you are new this morning and it's a blank slate. But most of you, you have a history and you have thoughts already coming in. So ethos is all of that. But ethos also has to do with the character of the listener and gets beyond just the logos and the pathos, but moving into what does this look like now as we live it out in life. You can make an argument that you should root for the Broncos, but what does this mean for your life? For most of you, nothing. For some of you, you might think differently about who you root for today, all right? The reason I bring all this up is when I start to prepare for a series, I start preparing by looking at the various commentaries. The commentaries are basically books written about different books of the Bible by modern authors trying to help you understand what it means. So my process most weeks is I spend time with a passage for a while. I study it. I look at it. I ask questions of it. I try to think, this is what I think it means. And then the second part of my process is I go to the commentaries and I start saying, okay, what do academicians say? What do scholars say? What's the history? What does Wikipedia say? More than you think. At least to check things. But I go through all the various sources. And inevitably, you have to end up choosing. So I usually, when a series is coming up a couple months out, I have some places that I go that recommend commentaries, and I'll buy two or three commentaries for a series like this. And so I already had one, and I bought three more for this, and I started flipping through them. And you have to make a choice at some point. You have to decide this person's view. Some of them kind of run in schools of thought, but you have to pick which school. And in this one, and we're going to get to it in a little bit, it has to do with who the target audience is. And there's one school of thought that says the target audience was this, and there's another school of thought that says it was this. And depending on how you answer that question, will color the rest of the thing. And so the commentary I'm using, just for those of you that are interested in this kind of thing and you want to follow along at home, is called Letters and Homilies for Hellenized Christians, Volume 2, A Socio-Rhetorical Commentary on 1st and 2nd Peter. Now let me just tell you off to the side. I just feel smarter for owning this book, right? The first day I opened up, I was like, man, I put on my glasses too. And then I felt really doubly smart reading my socio-rhetorical commentary, 1st and 2nd Peter. But despite the title, it makes a lot of sense. And all he's trying to say is that we're going to approach Peter looking at his social setting and comparing him to forms of rhetoric that existed in Greece at the time. So the Greeks, with Aristotle, about 300 BC, developed rhetoric, and the Greeks prided themselves on rhetoric. And oftentimes, in classical liberal arts education, we go back and we study the rhetoric of the Greeks and how did they make arguments. And in college, I was on a college, not debate, but it's called forensics. It has nothing to do with bones. Intercollegiate speech competitions. And so I traveled, you know, Miami of Ohio and Ohio State and Indiana and Ball State and all these places, and I competed every weekend in college in this stuff. And there was forms to this. There was ways that so I was in impromptu. My coach forced me into impromptu. I did not want to do impromptu. It's as terrifying as it sounds. You walk into a room, there's a piece of paper laying on a desk, upside down. You take the paper, you pick it up, and you flip it over, and the judge sitting in the back starts a clock. A stopwatch. You now have, I think it's 7 minutes total. And what the expectation is that you get 2 minutes of prep, 5 minute speech. That's what you do. So you walk in, you pick it up. And so in my mind, I had a form that I started going through. Okay. And it was always a quotation. So I just take the quotation. I read it. Do I agree or disagree? If I agree, why do I agree? One, two, three, four, if I have time. And then, well, how am I going to conclude this thing? And so in 2 minutes, I had a note card and a pen. I just hurried and scratched some notes. Here's the introduction. Here's my proposition. The proposition was always a form of I agree or I disagree. Here's my arguments. Bam, bam, bam. I did. That was the form I followed almost every time. Except that the added bonus of my friend Greg and I, who did it together, right before we would enter the room usually, we would give each other something that we also had to work into the speech. So like oftentimes he'd be like, Pearl Jam, Jeremy, go. And so I'd have to come out of the room and report to him how I made Pearl Jam songs Jeremy one of my points, one of my major points. And so we'd do that to each other all the time, which, you know, it was already fun enough. That just added an extra level of fun. Do I have time to do this? I had one time, I knew the judge. He was the judge at Miami of Ohio, and he had gone to my college and now was the director of their program. And he was the judge in the room, and there was a spot, and I can't even remember what it was. I wish I could remember, where I said something so stupid, all right, that he laughed at me in the middle of my speech, and I laughed too, and like kind of snickered, and then after the round, I saw him, and I looked at him, and he just busted up. He's like, that was the dumbest thing I've ever heard in a round. I was like, thank you. Impromptu, you never know what's going to happen. So all that to say. What Ben Witherington says is that when we look at the letter of Peter, Peter is following, because Peter is Hellenized, because Peter lives in Rome, Peter is following standard progression of rhetorical argument that you would have found all throughout the Greek Empire. This is not a different kind of literature. This is the kind of literature that would have been very, very common. And so when he starts looking at the book, he starts asking, how do we think of Peter as a big rhetorical argument? And he takes it and divides it that way. Now, the guy that put the chapter and verse in the Bible, he apparently didn't believe this because it's all over the map, all right? So as we go through it, I'm just going to throw this up here real quick so you can see this is the way we're going through it. This morning, we're going to talk through the greeting. And that's it, because it'll give us a little bit of context. We're just going to talk through the greeting. And then next weekend, next Sunday, I'm going to talk about the exordium. And the exordium is the part of the speech where you build a connection to the audience. So the idea here is that what Peter's going to do is he's not going to get to his argument yet. That's going to come on our last Sunday here, September 29th. He's going to get to this point where he talks about some stuff, but he's trying to build some rapport with his audience, that ethos thing. He's trying to build some rapport with them. It would be like if I was a visiting speaker here this morning and I came into this church for the very first time and you all didn't know me. I would introduce myself. I would do the greeting, and then the exordium might be that thing where I say something like, you know, got here last night, and I'm a guest of Josh. Josh is going to invite me in, and I'd tell a story about Josh, and then I might say, I got to go to 3030 Coffee this morning, get some coffee. Man, I really love this, and I got to go here last night. I really like your town. I'm building a bridge. Totally lying to you, but I'm building a bridge to you about something else. So that when I get to my proposition, you're in a favorable position to hear it, okay? And that's what we're going to get to next week. Peter is going to kind of go into some flowery thing, but it's really him just building a bridge to his target audience so he can get to the propositio. And if you want that, why don't you just turn in your Bible? Let's go ahead and do this. I want to read this one for you so you can see what it's going to be, and then we'll flesh this out on September 29th. That's on page 980. We get to Peter's main argument as he's going through 1 Peter. One other little note about Parkview. It's bright enough in that room, I shouldn't have to use glasses in the service for at least 3 years. I'm projecting that I can get rid of the glasses, it'll be bright enough that I can see without the glasses, and I can get a reprieve from wearing glasses. Woohoo! All right, 1 Peter 1, verse 13. Therefore, with minds that are alert and fully sober, set your hope on the grace to be brought to you when Jesus Christ is revealed as his coming. As obedient children, do not conform to the evil desires you had when you lived in ignorance, but just as he who called you is holy, so be holy in all that you do, for it is written, be holy because I am holy. That's Peter's main argument, and we might even read that week after week after week to just pound that back in. That phrase, be holy, if I had to just do something for the whole series, be holy in everything you do because I am holy, that's what Peter's driving at. If you were here a couple weeks ago, you heard me say that I'm a little terrified of 1 Peter. Part of the issue is that in our tradition, we don't talk about holiness a whole lot, and Peter is just going to slam us with holiness. And I anticipate that it might be uncomfortable at some points for us. Okay? So what Peter does then is for us, then the next week we'll be over at Parkview, and that first week over there, we're just going to celebrate. But then the next 5 weeks are five arguments that Peter lays out that either illustrate or persuade or convince or show you how this works out in life, gives examples. That's what he's going to do for the next 5 weeks. And we'll have real headings for these. I just didn't want to give away this early. But we'll have headings for each one of those as to how this, and the job of each of us, I think I'm teaching four of those and Dustin's teaching one. Each one of those, it's on Dustin and I to help you understand, here's how this connects back to 1 Peter 1, 13 to 16. This is how Peter is building this argument in a rhetorical fashion to keep showing us why this thing is true, why he's trying to convince us of this thing. Does this make sense? I think those of you that are very left-brained, you're going to love this, right? Because rhetoric is very, very structured. There's a very intent form here. Then he's going to end on the peroratio. This is the appeal to passion. This is where he's just going to like, all right, if I haven't convinced you by all the logic stuff, let's have an emotional appeal. And so Peter's going to do an emotional appeal there at the end, and then we get the closing hymn and salutations where he says, adios, I'll write you again in 2 Peter. All right? That's going to be the form. I see some of you scurrying and writing this down. I was going to try to do it this morning, but it just didn't happen. I'll try to print off an outline for you, and we'll put it up as a PDF online if you want to do that. That way you can see where we're going. And maybe I'll even attach dates to it so you know when the teaching calendar, when we're coming to each one. Is that, would you all like that? I see a few of you nodding. I'll have that for next week, all right? And maybe even tomorrow we'll get it up online, and then we'll have hard copies for you next week, okay? So let's go to 1 Peter 1, verses 1 and 2 this morning. Peter, an apostle of Jesus Christ, to God's elect, exiles scattered throughout the provinces of Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, and Bithynia, who have been chosen according to the foreknowledge of God the Father through the sanctifying work of the Spirit to be obedient to Jesus Christ and sprinkled with his blood, grace and peace be yours in abundance. I think at Imago Dei Church, this is the shortest bit of text I've ever taught on, all right? Two verses. What stands out to you? What's important? What's significant? What words? What ideas? What questions? We have time. I'll read it again if you'd like. Yeah, go ahead. It sounds like an argument for predestination. Yes, this is one of those arguments where if you grew up in some circles of Christianity, not everybody grew up in this world like I did, that the argument about did God decide who was going to be saved beforehand, most likely not at all what he's talking about. And sometimes people come to these, they see that word and it triggers, and there's another word in here that triggers us, to God's... I got to put my glasses on. Who have been to God's elect, exiles, though all those words, elect, exiles, both of those just trigger all kinds of theological stuff. I'm going to save it because I'm going to come back to that. Probably not exactly what he has in mind, all right? Because he's talking here about elect according to foreknowledge, which seems to indicate that God had this idea that there would be a group called the church, not specific individuals. But anybody else? Yeah, so what Peter's concerned about here, even from the beginning, so in his salutation, introduction, he's even already starting to hint at what his big argument is going to be, is that it's not about you're saved to be, or you're not elect to be saved, but to be obedient. He's already starting to sound the note of obedience here from the very, very beginning. Somebody else is over here. Yeah, so exiles doesn't feel too good to us. I want to unpack in just a minute what that means exactly. And it has a very specific connotation to them of what it means to be exiles. But oftentimes, I'll tell you what we often think. I think in a lot of, especially Evangelical Church America, we tend to think exiles, well, heaven's our home. We're not home here. We're exiles. And I don't think that's at all what Peter has in mind at all. He's talking to a very specific group, which we'll talk about in just a minute. Anybody else? Grace, yeah. Super common greeting in the New Testament. If you look through all of Paul's letters, Paul often does the grace and peace, and that seems to be a formulation that was true in the early church, which is really beautiful. So grace, kairos, is the Greek term. peace, shalom, the Hebrew, it kind of pulls both audiences. It acknowledges that the early church was at least a mixed audience all the time, that you get both of those things together. And so it comes to be Paul's favorite intro. I don't think, if I can remember right, Peter doesn't use the same intro in 2 Peter, but Paul almost always uses some version of that. Yeah, okay, so interesting. I wasn't going to do this, but since you pointed out, I'll take a little tangent, all right? So the order there, he gets all three persons of the Trinity, so who have been chosen to the foreknowledge of God the Father through the sanctifying work of the Spirit to be obedient to Jesus Christ. Now, we don't usually say Father, Spirit, Son. We say what? Father, Son, Spirit, which reflects probably something of an error in our theology that we rank them. We always think in terms of Father, Son, Spirit. They're ranked that way. And what I think is happening here is for Peter writing to a Jewish audience, which I'm going to talk about in just a minute, they knew of God and they knew of God's Spirit, but Jesus would have been the new peace for them. And so the order there reflects his Jewish audience that he's going through that way. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And that's exactly where that comes from. In the Hebrew mindset, God, yeah, we get. Spirit, yeah, we get. Jesus? You know, like, that's the twist. That's been the revolutionary twist for them. It's not God and Spirit, but Jesus. Yeah, that's good. All right, let's get through it. A couple of things as we work through this. First of all, Peter introduces himself as an apostle. Can we do this for just a minute? I want to do this very quickly. How, for those of, for the people that weren't here all summer, all right, where we talked about the life of Peter, tell me about the person of Peter. What makes Peter especially qualified? Why is this interesting? If this is in the form of rhetoric, the greeting where the author sets himself up and says, this is who I am, what makes Peter qualified? There's some big ones. Yeah. He's like Jesus' BFF. Transfiguration. Yep. Absolutely. So this word apostle has maybe a couple different meanings, but when it applies to Peter and some of those, it really, and Paul kind of sets this up, that it refers to those who saw Jesus. That Peter is hinging his credentials on, I'm one of the people who saw Jesus. The word apostle simply just means a messenger. But for Peter and the early apostles, it came to kind of mean that those who had seen Jesus. And so what's interesting about Peter, you know, we have the On This Rock I'll Build My Church, we have all the experiences of Jesus, not just that he's Jesus' best friend, but all the shared experiences. That what we see in Peter is this idea that Peter has one foot in the world of Jesus and one foot in the world of the early church. That Peter is the translator for the early church. So as he goes into Asia Minor, which I'll put up in a map in just a minute, as he goes in Asia Minor and meets all these people who didn't live in Palestine, who didn't meet Jesus in person, who didn't see Jesus do the miracles, who weren't there at the crucifixion, Jesus or Peter has his foot in that world. His credentials are, I ate dinner with him all the time. But he also has his foot in the world of the early church, and I'll show you that in just a second. The second thing that we get to in this passage, I should just move my Bible up here, is that list of places. And so this was an encyclical, all right? So when Paul writes letters to, let's say, Ephesians, Paul's writing to whom? The Ephesians, thank you. It wasn't a trick question. All right, so that letter, want to do it again? When Paul wrote the Corinthians, who was he writing to? The Corinthians. That letter was going to a specific church in a specific location. That's not what's happening here. Peter is not writing to one church, but really just like all the churches in kind of that area, all right? And he names them all. Now, people make a big deal to note that in an encyclical, the order is usually the order that the letter would have traveled. So the first place that this letter would have traveled would have been Pontus, then Galatia, then Cappadocia, and Asia and Bithynia. What's interesting about this order, just a little side note, is it's backwards. If Peter's writing from Rome, which we're sure he was, Rome is over here, he wouldn't have started in Galatia. He would have started with Asia over there. And so what they think Peter's doing here is that Peter's listing the cities probably in the order of his life's journey, coming out of Palestine post Acts 15, when Peter kind of rides off into the sunset of Acts, at least, that he journeyed from this direction. And so that list might be the order of the towns in which he ministered in the order that he would have ministered them to. It's not super important. But just to know that this, because it's written to a bigger area, this letter gets more general. So you think about Corinthians, right? And you get these very specific situations. situations in the Corinthian church. This thing is happening, knock it off. This thing is happening, do this. That's not the tone of 1 Peter at all. 1 Peter's much more broad because he's talking to a broader population of people spread out geographically over all of what we know today as Turkey. Okay? Capiche? So who is this target audience? I'm going to go with the commentary, and we can argue afterwards if you want. But it seems that Peter's audience, and we'll keep pointing to this throughout the book, is that his audience is diaspora Jews. Now, what this means is this. It's simply this. When the Roman Empire comes in and takes over Palestine, and if you read the Maccabees and you read History of the Jews and you get into the Hasmoneans and the Maccabees and all the wars and all these things, what you find out is that Palestine was an incredibly... It was just a violent era. There was always uprisings. There was always something going on. They were always in the news of the day. Kind of like now and last year and forever. Always in the news. And so if you're Romans, one of the ways that you handle the problem in Palestine is you take groups of people and you just take them out and you move them to elsewhere in the empire. And then you transplant Roman citizens. You give Roman citizens perks for living in that place. And so you can bring down the rebellion if you just get them out of there. And so what had happened is you can look throughout the history of the Roman Empire at different times. They had taken Jews and they had moved them in. And these became known as diaspora Jews. They were Jews that weren't in the homeland. They were, the word, they were exiles. So when he writes to exiles, that's just what they are. I don't think there's any big theological intent behind Peter. He's just acknowledging that you are the people that left your homeland, that you're not in Palestine like you're supposed to be. You're not in the land that you're supposed to be. You're elsewhere. And so what happened is as these Jews then incorporated into Roman society, they came in the Roman Empire, this class of people known as resident aliens. So in Rome, you had the citizens, full citizens who had all the rights of citizens. And then you had like the slave class, which, sorry, but women and slaves were kind of down here. Resident aliens occupied this space in the middle. They didn't have all the rights of a Roman citizen, but they could participate in trade and commerce and all those things. They could be a part of life in a regular Roman colony. And so what we find from archaeological evidence is that there's a big concentration of Jews in Asia Minor. And in particular cities, they find, just like here, where different ethnic groups kind of cluster in one place, like in Peoria, it's the Lebanese. Welcome to your town. There's a large Lebanese population in Peoria, New York City. I think I've heard before there's more Jews living in New York City than there are in Israel. Like, there's just big pockets. In the same way, these Jews would begin to congregate in places, and there's places in the ancient world when they do archaeology, they find that there's cities that are predominantly Jewish. Or not predominantly, but just huge, huge pockets of Jews. And so you get this thing going on where they're resident aliens, where they're together, they're not exactly citizens. So what that looks like is while they can participate in the life of the town, they are prohibited from a lot of social clubs because of their eating restrictions and because of their lifestyle choices and because the Jews are going to practice Sabbath and the Jews aren't going to eat meat sacrificed to idols and the Jews aren't going to be a part of temple worship to Diana or whoever the goddess of that town is. And so there's a lot of social isolation. They are isolated socially in their towns. They're set off from their towns. So when we start talking about holiness throughout the book of 1 Peter, the idea of holy is to be set apart. And one of the things Peter's going to say to us is, you were set apart before, but now I'm asking you to choose to be set apart. So what's happening is these Jews, if you move there in 300, you get in this place, you're a resident alien. The challenge for you is that you're set apart. And then the Christians come in and tell you, by the way, the food thing, eat whatever you want. The Sabbath thing, you don't exactly have to do that anymore. And they start taking down when the Christians come along. One of the reasons it's so appealing to these Jewish Christians or these Jews living in all these places is the thing that keeps them set apart from their culture, they're being told, you don't have to be set apart for that anymore. I don't have time for that. So that's what's happening. So as they come into faith then, Peter's going to challenge them. Hey, listen, as you do this now, you were set apart because you didn't eat pork and you didn't worship it here and there. But now I'm asking you, be set apart because of this. Be set apart because of your righteousness. Be set apart because of how you follow Jesus, even if it's not about pork and temple worship. Does that make sense? So that's the audience that Peter's talking to. We're going to use the phrase Hellenized Jews. All we're talking about is people who have adopted Greek thought, which is everybody in that time. And so the specific audience then we have is Hellenized Jewish Christians. So the idea of Hellenized, that they have Greek thought, that's why Peter's writing in a rhetorical style, because that's the way they think, even though they're Jews. But that's who we're talking about. So then we see, so you've been chosen according to the foreknowledge. All right, hold, let me back up. To God's elect exiles. So to God's people, I think specifically here he's talking to God's elect, the Jews, exiles that have been scattered throughout the provinces. So there have been the diaspora Jews scattered throughout these regions. And then he has this big theological statement, who have been chosen according to the foreknowledge of God the Father through the sanctifying work of the Spirit to be obedient to Jesus Christ and sprinkled with his blood. One of the themes that we're going to get to really big over the next couple weeks is this idea of obedience and covenant. Obedience and covenant. So we